Well, good evening, everybody. So if you haven't picked up the handouts, do that for tonight. We're actually behind the handouts you got last week. We'll start with the last ones of those. So we haven't completed all the handouts I gave you last time. You can either look at it two ways. Either I'm behind in my teaching or I'm ahead in my prep. So however you want to look at that. But pick up the new ones each time. But I think I'll make it clear which one we start with here when you see the slide. So it's very good to be together. Frank, would you lead us in a prayer as we start the study, please?
Our Father in heaven, we're thankful that we're able to come together tonight to study your word. Pray that you'd be with us in the study and that we'd learn how to better serve you. Ask you to be with Philip as he proclaims your word to us and help us all to understand. Thank you for forgiveness of our sins and pray that you continue to bless those that are sick and watch over those that continue to have problems. Ask you to bless us through this study. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. So we're looking at a lot of information, and I'm going to say something that I've mentioned before. The weeds get really thick in this material about what happens before the New Testament and after the Old Testament. It's a lot of information flying, and you can drown in it. So what I'm attempting to do is simplify it and give the pertinent information that helps us to understand who the people were in the New Testament, the different kinds of people, how they were affecting one another, and the cultural, historical setting that they find themselves in. Because the more you understand that, the more the New Testament will impact you, and including reading down the Gospels. So we've used this diagram, and we'll see it in a moment. I don't have it up right now, about Jewish society, Roman rule, and Greek culture, and how that they're affecting one another. They're influencing one another, and they're clashing against one another. And we're going to really see that tonight. We're going to start now really focusing on Jewish society in the New Testament, or at least what created New Testament Jewish society. And who were the Jews when you open up the books of the New Testament, especially the Gospels, and you see that it's a Jewish world that Jesus is living in. It's a different set of Jews than when the Old Testament ended and what's happened in between. So that's what we're hoping to set up. And one of the reasons why the Jewish society is different than at the close of the Old Testament is because they've been affected by Greek culture and Roman rule. And you can't understand them unless you see that. We talked about last week the interaction of these three, Jewish society, Roman rule, and Greek culture, in a couple of passages. For instance, we cited in Acts 16 the case of Timothy. Why is Timothy's situation unique?
His dad is Greek.
He's half Jewish, half Greek. But he's been raised to believe in the God of the Old Testament, and his mother and grandmother and himself, at least, had become what? Christians. And Paul, Jewish rabbi, takes him into Greek territories to preach the gospel and prepares him for synagogue visits by having him circumcised. You're talking about an interplay between Greek, Roman, and Jew. And then we saw in Acts 25 when Paul is at Caesarea Philippi and he's been examined by Roman authorities and he's brought before the governor Festus and King Agrippa, who's actually Herod Agrippa II, which is like a great-grandson of Herod the Great. And he's standing before these two like Roman authorities and he's defending the gospel of Christ. But when he's making his defense, it comes up that he had had this extensive training as a Jewish rabbi. So there are those worlds all clashing there, even once again. You see it and look for it in a lot of places. So now the time's finally come for us to look at Jewish society. So what we're going to do is go backwards from some highlights we've already hit. Some time ago, we talked about the major developments regarding the rise of Alexander the Great, the spread of Hellenism, Greek culture, after his demise, And then the rise of the Romans and how they became the rulers of the Mediterranean world. And you can see the dates there. That's happening over several centuries. So we're going to go back and look at how that when these things were developing, what's happening in Jewish society. So that's where we're at. You might have a question on where we're at. That's a handout from last week, I think. So let's talk about this thing of Hellenistic rule. What are some ways that Greek culture... What are some aspects of Greek culture that spread after the conquest of Alexander? What are some things about the Greeks that were everywhere? Yes?
Their language.
Let's just start with number one. Excellent.
Their fashion. I mean, a lot of it.
Yes, even the clothes. Yes. But that language is huge because it has a bearing on the New Testament. But yeah, the architecture, the literature, they started believing in the Greek mythology tales about the gods. That just spread in the Middle East, down in the South Asia, across North Africa, and certainly down through Palestine. So what's happening to Jewish people as they're affected by Hellenistic culture and Hellenistic rule? So here's what we're going to look at. When Alexander dies... He had no apparatus for how his empire would continue. Matter of fact, it's so big, it can't be centrally governed. It's too big. But he died young, early 30s, and basically there was a power struggle among his generals. And about four of them ended up carving up the empire. And the two that are so relevant to the New Testament are the Seleucids, that really have their base of operations in what we know as Syria, this part of the Middle East right there. Then the other group are the Ptolemies, which are down in Egypt. And so the old ancient Egypt that we know in the Old Testament, they'd had their glory days. The people who are ruling Egypt now are Greeks who have conquered Egypt. But they're all in love with Egypt. You know, like we're fascinated with something old, whether it's... like we're fascinated with the Greeks and the Romans. They were fascinated with the Egyptians, that kind of thing. So the Ptolemies were down here. And look who's in the middle. Who's in the middle? Judea. The Jews are in the middle. They've returned from Babylonian captivity, right? The Persians have put them back here. And they are like, in a way, a political football being kicked around. There are sometimes, and we'll see this tonight, they're very strong and they're able to withstand the Seleucids or the Ptolemies. But oftentimes, they just don't have the numbers and the resources to withstand the political rule. So really, for a long time, the Ptolemies sort of ruled them from a distance. They collected tribute from them. But then things began to change. And what happened was, by the late 2nd century on... So you're looking at the high 100s. Seleucids got control of Judea. And especially this guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, which means basically he's the great one. That's what Epiphanes means. And I think he took on that name himself, by the way. But there are a lot of Antiochuses among the Seleucids. It's sort of like a name like Caesar. And he's the fourth. And what happens to Antiochus is that he actually makes a run down into Egypt around the time that the Romans come into Egypt. The Romans are not flexing any muscle in here yet, but the Romans are flexing muscle down here. They're very interested in Egypt because it's prestigious. And he encounters a Roman military there, and basically they shut him down and send him home. There's a story, and I'll just tell you. The Roman commander says, you need to leave Egypt. And basically Antiochus says, I'll think about it. And the Roman commander took his sword and drew a circle around his feet and said, you can think about it while you're in that circle, but by the time you come out of that circle, you need to have an answer. So basically what he's telling him is get out of Egypt, and he did. And he's in a very foul mood when he comes out of Egypt. And he's also deprived of resources. He's at a low ebb as far as his resources. And so he decides to hit Judea hard. He extracts a lot of tribute from them. Matter of fact, he sells the office of the high priesthood to somebody. He's actually of a priestly lineage, this man was. But he actually paid Antiochus Epiphanes to be the chief priest. Now, what is that telling you about the priesthood at this point? So Antiochus decides that he doesn't like this Judaism business, and he invades Jerusalem. He sets up pagan images in the temple. He roasts a pig on the altar of incense and the altar of burnt offering out in front of the temple. And he does it. He knows this is offensive to the Jews. He does it anyway. And he makes it illegal to possess any copies of the scriptures or to circumcise your boys or do anything at the temple in worship that's Jewish. He basically outlaws Judaism. And so the Jews are oppressed here, okay? And basically he's trying to shut them down. He's trying to turn them into Hellenists. Well, some Jews gave in to this. Some did not. Some resisted. And that brings us to a real dilemma here. We're going to look at this revolt that's going to take place, but I want to identify something. And that is, it's there. Sorry, I was looking at the wrong place. What happens here, starting with the pressing by Antiochus Epiphanes and the Seleucids, is about a 2-century long experience of whether it's somebody who's Greek or the Romans, that Jews have to decide how they're going to react to these forces. And they basically got 2 choices that you see. And there's some variations of them. One of them is to just accommodate the outside forces and give in to them and make compromises so they can keep their identity as Jews and maintain some semblance of their Judaism. Were there devout Jews at this time who were really serious about God and keeping the law? Sure. But a lot of these people were cultural Jews. It's their heritage. It's their tradition. But even that was meaningful to them. And so if they had to compromise a little bit with the Seleucids or later on with the Romans, that's okay as long as they can keep their Jewish identity and practicing some of their cultural rituals. Others, though, were very motivated by their faith in God. The other reaction to this is that you don't cooperate with outside authority. You look for ways to resist because you're trying to keep your purity and your fierce independence. And there's a broad spectrum here. You can almost put these on 2 ends, and you've got people all in the middle, okay? Some are mildly resistant, some are violently resistant. Some are giving in to the outside forces, just whatever they want. And then there are some others that are sort of compromising here and there, but not on everything. They'll go so far, but they won't go all the way in compromising with the outside forces. And I want you to see this biblically. Let's look at some passages here. So first of all, Mark chapter 3. Well, that's not showing up good, is it? Mark chapter 3, verse 18. Rachel, can you read that in just a moment? And then Joe, can you read John 11:48 in just a moment? And then Olivia, Luke 20, 21, and 22. And then Neil, can you read the last one, Acts 24, 1 to 3, when I call for it? So let's start with Mark chapter 3. This is a list of the apostles. Go ahead, Rachel.
And Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus and Simon the Zealot.
And Simon the what? The zealot. That term can be one of 2 things in the first century. It can be someone who's zealous for Jehovah. Of all the apostles and what we know about them, who would you describe as spiritually for God zealous? Peter?
Simon.
Okay. Well, he is. Okay. 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 Other footnotes. But it can mean someone who's just zealous for God, but you see that with Peter and Andrew and James and John, and you see that with a lot of these. Why is this Simon set apart? Well, there's another meaning for zealot. The zealots, they were actually a group of Jews who had sworn to fight off Roman occupation. And they were even using terrorist tactics. You know, like terrorists, like we know a terrorist does. Terrorist group are people who are marginalized. They don't have actual political power. So what do? What power do they use? Pardon?
Freedom.
Violence. Yes. Okay. So they would sneak up in Jerusalem to some official they didn't like, either a Roman official or a Jewish official. And they would have daggers under their cloaks and stab them and run away. Things like that happen all the time. So zealots were violent groups of Jews who wanted to throw off Roman oppression. One of the apostles had that background. And also one of them did what for a living for the Romans? Simon and Matthew were like this politically. So, see that tension right there. See where Simon the Zealot is in this on this spectrum? The next one, John chapter 11, verse 48. This is after the resurrection of Lazarus, okay?
If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation.
This is Caiaphas the high priest saying, this Jesus thing is out of control. He's doing these signs. If we let him keep doing this, the Romans... He thinks there's going to be a breakdown in society and the Romans will come in and crush the situation and take away self-rule. Because see, as high priest, him and all his cohort of high priests and Sadducees, they were the power brokers in Judea. We'll see this later. And so, see where they're at? They don't want to lose favor with the Romans. You see that? All right, look at Luke 20, 21 and 22. This is the last week of Jesus' life when he's being tested in Jerusalem.
Then they asked him, saying, "Teacher, we know that you say and teach rightly, and you do not show personal favoritism, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?"
This is one of the hot button issues of Jews politically in this day. So if Jesus says, yeah, pay taxes to the Romans, it makes him look like he's a compromiser with the Romans. If he says, no, don't pay taxes, then that puts him in the category of like a zealot or something. So he's bound to offend one or the other. And Jesus says, he takes the denarius and says, whose inscription's on it? Render to Caesar things that are Caesar and to God the things that are God. You can render to Caesar but not compromise what you render to God is what he's teaching. And by the way, I just say this while I'm thinking about it, and it may be later on that I'll bring it up, but it's hard to know exactly, but the best estimate of how much taxes the Jews paid in Palestine at this time, it was really one big work was done in the 1920s. The research was done on it by a guy. He estimates it's somewhere between 30 to 40% of what they earned because they had the temple tax. And then they had the tribute tax. In other words, they had to pay a tax to the temple as Jews to run the temple and all that. But then they had to pay a tax to the Romans. Then they had commercial taxes. Like if you brought goods from one place to the other, there'd be a custom collection there. And so it ran as high as 30 to 40%. And guess what? A lot of those Jews didn't have hardly any excessive income. Expendable income anyway. So, if you want to complain about your taxes, fine. You have a lot more than they did, and your taxes are a lot lower. Okay? That's just the reality of it. The tax burden was heavy. It really was. So much that Herod the Great, we'll talk about him later, Herod the Great realized that, and sometimes he would lift the tax when there was a famine. He knew that. He was smart. He didn't want an insurrection. He would, you know, reduce the taxes if there was famine, like a blight or something. So look at that tension there. See that? Where are you going to fall on the spectrum? Cooperate with the Romans or resist them? Pay taxes or not? See that tension? All right, and then Acts 24, Neil's going to read that. That's when Paul has been arrested because of the uproar in the temple in Acts 20 and 21. He's before Felix, but they're bringing the prosecutors in from the Jewish leaders. So 1 to 3 there. Neil, thank you.
And after 5 days, the high priest and us came down with certain elders, an orator, one Tertullus, and they informed the governor against Paul. And when he was called, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, seeing that by thee we enjoy much peace, and that by the providence evils are corrected for this nation, we accept it in all ways and in all places, most excellent Felix.
Okay. So these are the chief priests coming down, really from the Sadducees. We'll talk more. Next week, we plan to talk about Pharisees and Sadducees extensively. So they're like the power brokers, and they're the ones most connected to the Romans. And they're bringing charges against Jesus. I'm sorry, against Paul. Pardon me. Bringing charges against Paul. They're the same ones that brought charges against Jesus, same group. When this spokesman speaks to the governor, the Roman governor of Judea, that verse 3 there, just in a very street kind of way, what's he doing to this ruler? He's buttering him up. He's kissing up to him. He's stroking him. He's pouring syrup and honey on him, however you want to put it. He's buttering him up. And that's what they did sometimes. Sometimes they butter up these Roman governors, like the day Jesus was crucified. Sometimes they pull the lever of, okay, if you do that, if you don't do what we want you to do, we're going to run to Caesar about this. You're no friend to Caesar's, okay, because he's making himself out to be a king. He needs to be crucified. So they knew how to pressure those Roman governors or to butter them up, depending on the situation. So do you see that tension there? So watch how, over the next couple of hundred years, spilling into the New Testament, all the way into the book of Acts, you'll see that tension. Do these Jewish people cooperate with these outside forces or resist them? And at what, to what scale? Yeah, Joe?
His speech, he's even subtly implicating the captain of the guard.
Yeah. Yeah, he does. The Roman. Yeah. Yeah, he was not reasonable. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So they're trying to manipulate this governor. Yeah. Well, what happens here after the Seleucids come in and really bring a hammer down on the Jewish people? Well, speaking of hammer, talk about a family, and the name of this family, technically it means the hammer, okay? So it's called the Maccabean Revolt. You see the dates there. It's 2nd century B.C. It lasts, it's intense at some time, sometimes it's subdued and not as violent. But many of the elites just sort of cooperated with Antiochus Epiphanes and the changes he's making, and they really didn't resist some of his laws that outlawed Judaism. They just sort of like, what can we do with this? And think about it, the elites always have more to lose, right? So they don't want their power stripped, their money stripped, their land, their resources, and so forth. However, the rank and file Jewish people obviously did not like this. Part of them didn't like it because of their faith in God. Part of them didn't like it because nobody wants somebody from the outside changing your ways and your culture and your habits and traditions. And so the rank and file among the Jews really didn't like this. And it really broke out with this man, Mattathias, who was a priest, but he was a country priest. He was not part of the elite priests working in Jerusalem. He's out in the countryside. And a Seleucid official wants some people to bow down to an idol in this village. And he commands Mattathias to do it. Mattathias wouldn't do it. And Mattathias draws a sword and starts hacking. And then his sons jump in. And then other people jump in. And they start slaughtering Jews that were cooperating with the Seleucids. And they start attacking the Seleucid forces. And now, violence breaks out. It's called the Maccabean Revolt because Mattathias lasts for so long, but in the middle of this insurrection, he dies, and he has one son to sort of take care of the money, but the son that he entrusts to be the military commander of this revolt is Judas Maccabees. And Maccabees means hammer. Sounds like a wrestler. Okay. And so he assumes leadership of the uprising, and they are surprisingly very effective, mostly through guerrilla warfare tactics. And guerrilla warfare tactics can be very, very successful, sort of like the Viet Cong thing in Vietnam, or the American revolutionaries against the Brits, okay, sort of another guerrilla tactic approach. And they can't really take the main Seleucid fighting forces on, but they have this hit-and-run tactics and so forth, And they really keep the Seleucid forces at bay. The Seleucid forces cannot, they have some success, but the Seleucid forces cannot subdue this uprising. And they've got the people in the country on their side, the countryside. Finally, the Maccabean leaders, the forces, take Jerusalem. They lose it later on, but they take it long enough to restore proper worship there. The temple has grown up with weeds. There are pagan images all around the temple and in the temple. So they come in and they clean it up. They tear down the pagan images. They reconstruct the altars. They put in a lamp stand in the temple. And because these are military forces that are setting this up, but of course the Maccabeans are priests. They're of the priestly lineage. They know what to do. They only had one jug of oil for the lampstand. Now, here is where I think the history goes this way and the legend, okay, takes over. According to, this all comes to us from the intertestamental books, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, as well as writings of Josephus and some others. But the Jews claim that they only had oil for one night, but that candle stand burned for 8 days and eight nights. And they claimed that it was a miraculous burning, whatever. And this breeds eventually, over time, a tradition called Hanukkah, Festival of Lights, and what Hanukkah is, which takes place in early December, and Jews still celebrate it today, is Hanukkah is a celebration of the restoration of the temple worship during the Maccabean Revolt, and the belief that the oil kept burning in that lampstand beyond its capacity. And so that's why you have the menorah and all that, okay? There's some other legends associated with it too, but that's the essence of it. But the Maccabean Revolt is not legendary. It's true. It's a real fight between them and the Seleucids. Finally, Antiochus Epiphanes dies. They all do. Alexander dies. They all die. Pharaoh died. Okay. Nebuchadnezzar. So Antiochus Epiphanes dies. They have just been drained of money trying to put down this rebellion, and they've got bigger fish to fry in other places. And so they let the people of Judea alone. And they let them, they sort of negotiate a peace, and they let them restore their religion without punishment, and they grant them some self-rule. But the Seleucids sort of stay there in power on the outskirts, you know, collecting some taxes and things such as that. Well, what happens now, any questions on that? I know this is mostly a lecture class, but any questions? Again, this is thick stuff. I'm just trying to give you the highlights. What happens next? I think this is fascinating for how misdirected people can get. It's called the Hasmonean Dynasty. What happens here is that the descendants of the Maccabees family, who have a priestly background, they have a priestly lineage, they set up a ruling dynasty, which is known as the Hasmonean Dynasty. You see how long it lasts there. It's pretty long. And it's really a ruling dynasty of priests. They're calling the shots. And at times, they'll still clash with the Seleucids. At other times, they'll strike deals with them. They're losing their edgy, revolutionary spirit that their ancestors had. They've settled down with self-rule. They're becoming respectable rulers now. And, the Seleucids began to get weaker and weaker. So, remember that map. If the Seleucids are getting weaker, then their frontiers are weakening, which is an opportunity for the Hasmonean dynasty to spread out. And they actually start spreading the borders of Judea, and they do it by claiming a kingship. The Hasmonean priestly rulers set up a kingship, and they set up a dynasty, and they pass a kingship on from ruler to son to son to son. Now, I put a question mark beside of that. We've had Jewish kings before, right? All kinds of Jewish kings in the Old Testament. But according to God's plan, who's supposed to provide the king? Tribe of Judah. The priests were of what tribe? Levi. Now, think about how presumptuous this is. The priests have turned their priestly ruling class into a dynasty. And it's pretty successful. They actually expand and push into other frontiers around Palestine there. And some of these ruling Hasmonean kings slash priests, think about in the Old Testament, kings and priests were always in a different role. And that's on purpose. They vacillated. Some of these Hasmonean rulers really would cooperate with the Seleucids. Others were resistant of them. They're not cooperative. And there's that dilemma again. So you actually have a new dynasty, a regal royal dynasty that sets up in Judea, but has nothing to do with David's lineage. It's from a group of priests who have assumed that role. And they become very powerful. That's what happens, right? When you get powerful, and you become rich, and you lose touch. And a lot of the common Jews resented them. Commoners resented them. There was one Hasmonean king. His name was Alexander. How do you like that for a Jewish king? Alexander. See what they're being influenced by? Hellenism. Alexander was hated by the common people. They would pelt him with rocks. He rounded up a bunch of rebels and had them crucified. Crucifixion starting to come into vogue at this time. And as they're hanging on a cross being crucified, he has these rebels, wives and children, brought before them and executed in front of them while they're being crucified. Isn't that something? That's the eternal lesson about revolutions. A group of people will revolt to make things better, and those revolutionaries oftentimes create a society that is more oppressive than the one they cast out. Antiochus Epiphanes never did that. He roasted a few pigs in the wrong place, but he never did that. So, see how messed up this gets? It's messed up. We're well into Luke now, and we're seeing that conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees, and we're going to see it with Jesus and the Sadducees, and you're like, man, this is all messed up. Yeah, I'm telling you why it's all messed up. It's been messed up for centuries. And Jesus walks right in the middle of this. And he's having to teach his message of the kingdom in the midst of this mess. So, let's see what happens here. Any questions on the Hasmoneans? Okay. Well, so, there's that diagram again. We keep emphasizing. What we see now in seed form is something that we see completely blossomed out in the Gospels. The Hasmoneans basically became political dealers. They are the priestly class, but they're just rank political operatives and rulers, okay? And really what they are, not racially and not by their bloodline, but by their attitude, what the Hasmoneans become is really the predecessors to what we see with the Sadducees, chief priests, and the elders. So whenever in the Gospels it says elders in conjunction with the chief priests and Sadducees, it's talking about the leading aristocracy of the Jewish society. So if the Hasmoneans are like the predecessors of the Sadducees and chief priests and the elders, well, you also have the opposite, okay? Or to some extent the opposite. And that is, some, even through the Hasmonean period, felt like that the Jews were being compromised by outside influences, and they wanted to resist it, and they wanted to maintain purity as the Jewish people. And they sort of have this original Maccabean spirit. Drive out the Greeks. We're Jews. And it's that kind of spirit that you see in the Pharisees and Zealots. The Pharisees were not violent, per se, like the Zealots were. But the Pharisees despised the Romans and wanted them out and really didn't want to pay taxes. Until they wanted to use Pilate against Jesus and cooperate with the Sadducees. So that's that spectrum there. And what you see, this thing is going to morph from the Hasmonean rulers to people like the Sadducees, from the Maccabean revolutionaries to either the milder spirit of the Pharisee, who's more concerned about, you know, some of the religious purities, to the zealots who wanted political purity, political independence. And they're willing to use violence for it. So you see where this thing's going. So now that brings us to the Romans. They've been, if you listen real closely, in the second century, you can hear Roman footsteps, okay? They're coming. And they arrive. But let me introduce this, because this is a more of urgent, relevant influence. If you look on this map here, and it's not the greatest map because I needed the space, there's an area south of Judea, and we say the New Testament, we talk about Judea, Samaria, and Galilee a lot. And by the way, the Samaritans really hassled the Jews through the Seleucid period, and oftentimes sided with the Seleucids, which created more hostility between Jews and Samaritans, already there from the book of Nehemiah and Ezra and Nehemiah. But south of Judea, an area down in here is called Idumea. It just sort of forms itself into a region. And a lot of the people who live there are descendants of the Edomites. They're talked about at the end of the Old Testament in the book of Obadiah. Does anybody know the Edomites actually claim descent from what Genesis character? Esau, okay. Jacob, whom God has chosen. Esau, he didn't choose. Book of Romans talks about that. So that's like, you know, the enemy of God's people kind of thing, the human representative. You know, Esau was a fleshly, profane man. Hebrews talks about that in the 11th chapter. So an Idumean ruler by the name of Antipater emerges here in the first century, early first century. And he sees an opportunity maybe to incorporate the Jewish area into his rule. And what he begins to do, or Edomite descent, is that one of the things that he does is that he claims to convert to Judaism. And I put that in quotation marks. Converted to Judaism. Don't take that seriously. That's going to be, you know, like you fill out a form, what's your religion? He's going to put Judaism, okay? But that's about as deep as it goes. It's a political thing. And the Romans are starting to expand in their Eastern Empire, Eastern Mediterranean region. They're really extending the empire, and they're coming into old Seleucid lands and conquering them. They're working their way down into Palestine. And Antipater sees this, and he befriends the Romans, and especially when Pompey invades Jerusalem. Pompey is a Roman commander who comes down from Syria, and he sees that this whole thing is wide open, and the Romans never saw a land they didn't want to conquer, hardly. And so he invades Judea. He surrounds the city of Jerusalem. He ends up destroying the walls of Jerusalem. And even though he doesn't do a real offensive thing like Antiochus Epiphanes and roasting a pig on the altar of burnt offering, when they seize Jerusalem, he's fascinated by the temple, and so he walks in the temple. He walks inside the temple, and even into the Holy of Holies. He wants to look, he's curious, he wants to look around. The Jews never got over that. They were very resentful of that, but they couldn't stop him. It's the Romans. And so he's just curious, what's this place look like? Are you saying that only one of the priests goes in here and only once a year? I want to see that. And he goes in there. Of course, what is this telling us about how sacred the temple is at this point? But Pompey brings Roman rule into Palestine. And Antipater allies himself with Rome. And this gets really complicated. So here's just, you know, I have to work to keep up with it. It's so crazy. It's just like a soap opera. But he allies himself with the Romans, and the Romans are smart. And they conquer, and they want tribute, but they're smart enough to know that sometimes you use the locals to rule. A lot of empires did that. And so they see this guy, Antipater, and he's got potential, and so they let him be governor, or procurator, it's like a governor of Judea. But of course he dies. He's assassinated, by the way. I told you it's a soap opera. And the son that emerges as the muscle son is Herod. And not just muscle, but incredibly intelligent. And so he follows suits. He first makes an ally of Mark Antony. This is at a time when Octavian and Mark Antony are working together, but then they're going to work against each other. He first bets on Mark Antony. Antony is defeated. Octavian emerges as Augustus eventually. He's smart, and he goes and he courts Octavian, and he just goes in and says, yes, Antony was my friend, but now you are, and I am loyal to you like I was to Antony, and I will be the man you can depend on in Palestine. And Octavian knew talent when he saw it. And so the Roman Senate made Herod king. He was given another title first, but eventually made king of Judea and Galilee, the two main pockets of Jews at this time. Think about the Gospels. Where was Jesus always operating? Judea and Galilee, back and forth, and then the perimeters. He made Herod the king, and it's through Herod, who also claimed to be Jewish in his religion, who knew the Jewish religion. And they're like, this is a guy who's got muscle, he's got brains, and he knows the territory. He knows the people. He's our man. So they made Herod king of Judea and Galilee. And he loved it. He had copper mines. He had all kinds of revenue coming in. He knew what pockets to put money in and what palms to grease. He was the consummate, successful human ruler. Herod the Great, as he's called. So Judea now becomes a tributary to the Roman Empire. This is late first century. This is decades before Jesus is born. Just decades. There are people seeing Herod come to power who are alive when Jesus is born. And so Judea is a tributary of Rome. They got to pay the taxes. Rome will protect them, but if they cause trouble for Rome, Rome will crush them. And the Romans realize, after all this history, that the priestly class is important. And so they're going to control it. They're going to appoint a priest from the lineage of Aaron, which now is very broad, but they're going to pick the high priest. Did you know that? The Romans picked the high priest. And those high priests in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, they're all handpicked by the Romans. So it's a political office. And they're not going to pick somebody that's going to be a problem for them. They're going to pick somebody who's going to be pro-Roman. And they're just rank political appointments. You read about these chief priests and high priests in the Gospels, and you're like, they stink. They just smell. Yeah. They're just rank, power-hungry politicians who knew the Jewish rituals. That's what they are. And you see what they do to Jesus, don't you? And even Pilate knew it. Why did they want Jesus executed? What did Pilate think? Envy. Jesus stepped into a really messed up situation. The gospel started to be preached in a really messed up situation. But that's okay. That's just sauce for the goose. Okay, I guess we can end right there. Ken's a lot more flexible than some people. All right, we'll start right there next time. Thank you. Thank you, Ray, for doing that tonight, though. It's a hard job.